We resume our meeting. We have five papers on hedging here. And Martin, are you going to do the first introduction, or is it Henry?
Henry's going to pick up and then Catherine.
Okay, Henry. You're going to discuss paper number 14, right? Please, go ahead.
Good afternoon. Agenda paper 14, disclosures of the dynamic strategies. At the July ISB meeting, the board discussed and tentatively decided on all of the hedge accounting disclosure requirements apart from dynamic hedging strategies. This paper provides a description of dynamic hedging strategies in paragraph 7, and I think it's worthwhile if we just spend a couple of minutes on the background and why we're discussing this paper today. You'll remember that in the exposure draft, we proposed the disclosure requirement where we said to provide information about the total exposure, how much of that exposure is hedged, and then at what rate that exposure is hedged. From the discussions and the feedback that we've had, we decided that that information might be commercially sensitive, and therefore we've changed that, and the tentative decision was to focus more on the hedging instrument and the terms and conditions of the hedging instrument. But throughout that process, we also established or thought that it might be less useful for entities that apply dynamic hedging strategies to disclose that information. So at the July meeting, we brought the recommendation to the board asking that we exempt entities that apply that strategy from the disclosure requirement focused on the hedging instrument's terms and conditions. And as a result of the discussions we've had, the board asked us to come back at this meeting on that topic. So the problems are discussed in paragraphs 10 to 13, and a summary of the information that we have tentatively decided to disclose so far that would be applicable are set out in paragraphs 14 to 15. Basically, the staff sees that the board has two alternatives. The first alternative here is to exempt entities from the disclosure requirement focusing on terms and conditions of the hedging instrument, but then to extend the description of the risk management strategy to focus on how this accounting model is used to portray the risk management strategy. The second alternative, of course, is not to exempt entities and to require the disclosure on the terms and conditions of the hedging instrument. At the July meeting, the board raised two concerns with the approach that was proposed, and that is how we will describe dynamic strategies, and we've set out how we feel that we could address that in the final standard in paragraphs 24 to 26. And the second concern regards the volume of hedged items and hedging instruments, and to get a sense of that and how we could propose the disclosure requirement be done. That's set out in paragraph 27 to 28. And then in paragraph 29, we also address a concern that was raised regarding a sense of volume. If the volume at the year end does not represent the normal volume throughout the year, that could be done in a similar way that IFRS 7 currently deals with a sensitivity analysis, and that is for entities basically to disclose that this does not represent the normal activity and obviously then what the normal activity does represent. So with that, the staff recommendation is set out in paragraph 30, and that is to exempt entities from focusing on or disclosing information on the terms and conditions of the hedging instrument, and rather to extend the risk management strategy discussion and how the accounting is applied. So with that, I'll hand it over to the board for discussion.
The usual suspect, John.
I just have a question. In paragraph 7, you say this is particularly the case for hedges of open portfolios.
Yep.
In paragraph 2, you talk about constantly evolving rebalancing. So if I'm a bank and I'm managing on an open portfolio basis and I'm rebalancing daily or weekly, would I meet this test?
I would just be careful there, because we've now got a kind of the term rebalancing meaning one thing. I'd be a bit careful using the word rebalancing in this situation, but I think what we'd rather look at here is if you've got a closed portfolio using the general model, and you've obviously got your existing hedging relationship with your hedged item hedging instrument, and it's about tweaking the quantities of the existing relationship, that's something completely different to what we're talking about here, which I'm sure you obviously know the difference. But just to clarify, I wouldn't go down the route of rebalancing.
Yeah, let me ask you a different way.
Okay.
A bank in general,
yep,
given that they've got deposits coming in and out every day,
yep,
and they've got loans being paid down, paid off, sold, whatever, so there's constantly churning, and they adjust the hedges to maintain a margin.
So basically resetting the hedging relationships.
Do they typically qualify or not?
If you frequently discontinue your hedging relationship and reset it according to what you can currently do in IS 39, then yes, this would fall under that.
Thank you.
Well, I agree with the staff recommendation in question one, but question one says, in turn, do you agree with paragraph 30, the recommendation as described? I do also agree with paragraph 30, but I notice that paragraph 30, and throughout this whole document, we use the term dynamic hedging, which I think is fairly well understood, and I very much like the definition that's in paragraph 7. You've defined dynamic hedging very simply that I could understand. But then for some reason, in paragraph 26, you make another recommendation which you don't ask us to vote on, and that is to never use the term dynamic hedging in the standard. I would use it. I think the example uses the word dynamic but doesn't use the whole term. And you say, well, this example will explain the board's conclusion. But I think the board's conclusion is better described in what you have in paragraph 30, which uses that term. So I would define it. I don't know whether you need it as a glossary term or in the introduction to this section. So that's my only recommendation.
Pat?
I have a question.
Oh, I was thinking about Patricia. You'll be next.
I don't know whether I agree or disagree, because I'm having difficulty understanding how broad this would apply. In other words, I understand your definition of dynamic hedging, and it seemed to me that pretty much meant that these would be the only disclosures about hedging that most financial institutions would have to make. Is that an incorrect conclusion?
If you'd allow me, I'd kind of take one step back here, and I'd rather approach this from a different perspective, as even if it is the case that many financial institutions would rather disclose this, I think the question that I asked myself was, is this useful information to disclose? And it's not about how many will use this kind of exemption, because it's not like we're losing information. It's more a question of, it's not useful to portray this information if you apply this process. So from that perspective, I don't think we're losing anything by doing this. There's no valuable information going at loss here.
But on the other side of that coin, are we gaining anything? I mean, I might agree with you that the information, the general disclosures that we've discussed, might not provide useful information in this situation. But is this really providing us with sufficient useful information?
I personally believe that this is definitely more useful doing this, because the usefulness that we gain out of this is understanding that an entity applies, first of all, this dynamic process, so we understand what they're doing. And then they describe how they're using this accounting model. And in the, I think it was the June ISB meeting where we discussed the whole discontinuation, and one of the big issues here is to understand what they're doing, understand how the accounting is being used as a surrogate for this kind of process that the accounting wasn't really designed to deal with, but we're kind of plugging it in there. So from that perspective, I do believe we're definitely gaining more information usefulness having them extend their risk management description in this way rather than having them disclose terms and conditions of hedging instruments in this scenario.
Stephen?
I've got two concerns. One is it obvious when dynamic hedging is taking place and when it isn't? And I guess you already answered that, and I accept that we can define it sufficiently well. But my question really is about paragraph 30 in A, B, and C. And the three sentences are information about, description of, and indication of. And what does that really mean? What are we going to get from this? Is it three sentences, or is it something rather more?
Pat?
Does Henry want to answer first?
I think there's always a risk with boilerplate disclosures. But in this instance and the way we're drafting the standard, I think it would be very difficult for an entity to get away with a three-sentence boilerplate disclosure requirement in this instance, because you've got all of these elements being disclosed. You've got the effects on the financial statements. You've got hopefully you remember the last discussion that we've had with disclosure. I was talking about the golden thread running through these disclosures, and you're going to have to explain that to make it make sense. And if you're going to do it in three sentences, it's not going to make sense. So from that perspective, I think when we're going into disclosure requirements and having them based on principles, I can understand the fear, but I wouldn't expect that to be the case in this situation, because there would be a lot of explaining to do.
The value is anyway not so much in the quantity, but in the degree of customization. And the more you put in here as kind of example boilerplates, the more you will have people copy-paste that rather than think about. They need to describe some aspects that we tell them what the aspects are, but we leave them to find the words. And if you need to find the words, that means you need to describe what you do.
My question, I guess, is similar. I understand through B and C you get how it applies, and you get, I guess, some volume information because you're talking about an indication of how frequently the hedging relationships are discontinued and restarted. So presumably they're going to get some volume of that activity. I mean, that's what I interpret that to mean. If that's the case, maybe you need to be more specific. But in addition, you ask, you know, what else might you want? And tell me whether or not I'm going to get this through some other source. Am I going to know the degree of effectiveness or ineffectiveness that this kind of dynamic hedging strategy creates? And the costs, because presumably if you're stopping and starting a lot, it's a higher cost strategy. Are you going to know those two things?
You'll know the ineffectiveness from the requirements that we've got under the heading effects on the financial statements, because there we set out what are your hedged items, hedging instruments, carrying amounts, effectiveness recognized, and all of that separated by risk category and all of that. So that you will know. In terms of the cost of the strategy, I'm not sure what you mean with the cost of the strategy.
The cost of the strategy are not driven by how often you rejig the hedging relationship, because you do that mostly with existing instruments. So it's not that every time you designate a new hedge relationship, it means you do that with new instruments, but you tenants really use predominantly instruments you already have. So this is used in an environment where people do their trades depending on economically what works for them, and then they go and look what can I designate.
And my last question then is, let's just assume that you have a bank that employs this strategy and winds down to a very low level their positions as of a balance sheet date. Would you get a distinctly different impression of that bank's position and use of hedging as opposed to a bank that doesn't worry about window dressing the balance sheet?
Are you talking about, I just want to make sure that I understand your question correctly. Are you talking about understanding two entities and being able to distinguish how they approach hedge accounting. So the one's winding down positions, the other one kind of keeps on going the way he's going. Will you be able to distinguish that?
Yeah, because presumably embedded in your recommendation is that you don't have to provide certain kinds of information. So the question is what am I losing and what am I not seeing if I compare those two companies side by side, one that employs principally dynamic hedging, winds everything down at quarter end, the other one that doesn't?
I think in terms of, first of all, yes, you'll be able to make a distinction between one applying a dynamic process and one not applying a dynamic process. Most definitely you'll be able to distinguish that because you'll have a description of your risk management strategy where you're saying, I'm doing this, and throughout your disclosures you'll say, under that heading and under this risk category that you'll have, you'll kind of explain that. On the other hand, you'll have somebody just kind of doing the normal thing under the general model that we've been discussing so far, and you'd definitely be able to tell the difference between the two, for sure.
If you compare, you have one subsidiary with the churning book, uses this, and you have one subsidiary that is just a financing subsidiary that has just stable last tranches of debt placements, the former one that churns frequently would give you this disclosure, the other one would not give you this disclosure because there you have everything, because for them this doesn't apply, and that's how you would have fairly distinct disclosure for those two.
Any more questions? Are we ready to answer question one? Do we agree with the staff recommendation in paragraph 30?
Ben, the second question is just a follow-on question, basically, just asking that now that you agree that we're going to do this, the question then just becomes, do you also agree that we should require a disclosure requirement that's currently similar to one already existing in IFRS 7, that if the volume, because at balance sheet date this is obviously a bit of a snapshot at one single point in time, and this is a very kind of flowing dynamic process throughout the year. So if the volumes at year end don't represent the normal volumes during the year, that we basically just disclose that fact. This is consistent to what we've already got in IFRS 7, just extending it to this scenario. So the question is if the board agrees to that, and that's set out in paragraph 31.
John?
I have a question along the lines of what Pat might have been asking, but in relation to this question. So I'm a $1 billion in derivatives and hedging instruments in this dynamic hedge, and I've wound down to $100 million. All I have to say is the 100 does not represent my activity during the year, and I'm done. Correct?
That is when you
tell the reader that on average I was $100 billion outstanding every month.
That is the way that IFRS 7, where we use this as a kind of...
I'm not asking about 7. I'm asking what the requirement
is. This is the same. So it only says the fact that, yeah, it's the same.
Okay. Can we answer this question affirmatively?
That pretty much concludes the disclosure side. Thank you very much.
Hans, can you turn mine?
Yes.
Okay, so the next paper is agenda paper 15. Yes, me again. But the last time for this meeting, I promise. So what this paper addresses is the transition to the new hedge accounting model. It contains 7 questions to the board, but before we get into any of those, I'm going to frame the discussion in terms of the staff's thinking on what the transition provision should be, and then open it up for discussion after I give a brief background. So first, just to briefly set the scene for what the staff thought about whenever they were evaluating the transition. Of course, we all know IS 8 says that generally transitions should be retrospective, if practicable. However, the ED proposed a pure prospective application due to the significant risk of hindsight in entities being able to go back and retrospectively designate relationships in the past differently than they originally were. Now, this transition provision was largely supported by respondents across different types of feedback groups. However, some respondents did ask for certain one-off transitional provisions, and the board did say in the basis to the ED that certain one-off transitional provisions would be evaluated in redeliberations. So now the purpose of this paper was for the staff to present analysis of what those one-off provisions should be and how the transition should work to the final standard. So with that background, the staff has some views on how to distinguish between different types of hindsight. These are addressed in sections A through C of the paper. The first type is hindsight related to retrospective designation. So for relationships, in order to retrospectively apply the new model, entities would have to actually go back to the original designation and change it. And this is the case for most retrospective application and most requests made by respondents. And the staff does not recommend this for similar reasons that the decision was made in the ED, and the staff believe this leading up to the ED, you know, due to that risk of hindsight. However, not all hindsight is created equal in the minds of the staff. There's also hindsight related to the application of a particular accounting treatment. What that means is basically an entity can retrospectively apply the new model to certain hedging relationships if the designation doesn't change upon transition to the new model. So basically, the relationship is designated the same under IS 39 and the new model, but the entity would have to go back and retrospectively make some valuation decisions. Specifically, where this is the case is related to the time value of options and forward points, where under both of the models, the relationship is designated as the intrinsic value of the option or the spot element of the forward. And so in these circumstances, the staff notes that the entities have been accounting for these things using hedge accounting under IAS 39 and will be doing so under the new model, that this information is available, which mitigates the risks of hindsight, and that it doesn't really result in useful information for ongoing relationships to switch from the IS 39 treatment to the new treatment in the middle of the relationship, given the mitigated risk of hindsight in these scenarios. And so for those two specific items, the staff does recommend retrospective application. And so with that background, I think the board could discuss questions one through five in the paper. The first question, which is on page 8, is related to retrospective application in general, where it would result in retrospective designation of the whole hedging relationship. So does anybody have any comments on that question?
Can we support this question? Yes? Okay. Go on.
Okay.
Yes.
So given the agreement, the next question is question 2, which is on page 9. Just to be very clear on this point, this relates to the mandatory effective date of the new model and how it relates to the overall IS 39 replacement project just confirming that the board does still want to align those phases. So basically, with the ED that's out right now on the mandatory effective date, whatever decision is made on that ED, would the board want to similarly consider Hetch Accounting to have the same effective date?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, Stephen.
Is it impossible for us to answer any other way? I mean, could this be applied to 39 or not?
Not to 39.
Well, I mean, could it be applied earlier than the other parts of IFRS 9?
That's that way. The ED proposed that any parts of IFRS 9 that are in place before the new model would have to be early applied before the new hedge accounting model could be applied. So based on what the ED said, no.
That was, I think, not the question, but this model has been designed taking into account what's already effective. So, for instance, for equities at various for OCI, you have now the accounting that you decided, and that wouldn't actually align with IAS 39. So you'd need to make other changes to bring it back to where classification and measurement of financial instruments.
And also, let's not forget that one of the main reasons for the proposal to move the mandatory effective date for IFRS 9 that already exists was to align with these phases.
Yes.
Okay, so we support the question.
Okay, so the next question is question 3 on page 12 of the paper, related to some requests by respondents to allow limited retrospective application to the major differences between the two models, specifically risk components, aggregated exposures, and groups and net positions. For these types of relationships would be covered by the SAS analysis on retrospective designation, and due to that, the risk of hindsight in those scenarios, staff doesn't recommend that. Does the board agree?
Do we support this? Yes. All in favor? Yes.
All right. So the next question, question 4, which is on page 15 of the paper, addresses the different kind of hindsight, which is the hindsight in applying evaluation retrospectively, not a designation. For this question, for the time value of options, does the board agree with the staff recommendation in paragraph 46 of the paper?
Daryl.
Just so I can understand it, when we talk about retrospective application here, there's retrospective meaning that on the first day of the new year, I will restate my opening balances, and there's also retrospective that means I will restate my comparatives. Does this refer to restating my comparatives?
You restate your comparatives for any relationships that were outstanding during the comparative period.
Does that then mean when I look at my comparatives, it's going to be four relationships that pass the old rules? I'm going to apply the new valuation methodology, but I'm not going to add in new relationships. So it's going to be a number that sort of is meaningless in the context of going forward.
Well, it's not a new valuation methodology for these changes. It's a presentation of the changes in the time value of the options, and for relationships that aren't outstanding during the comparative period, it's already washed through retained earnings.
It's a question of location, really.
Is it? Okay,
yeah. So it's a geography question.
It's just whether it sits in OCI or whether it goes to P&L.
It's just about reporting the true cost of hedging for that one-sided protection.
But you are going to change that in the prior period.
Yeah.
And it means that the prior period is sort of, it feels to me like the prior period is neither fish nor fowl. It's not what the old method used to be, but it's also not what the new method's going to be, because there's going to be a whole bunch of other changes to the new method. Or am I missing the point?
What this is designed to achieve is that you don't cut during the life of an option that stretches over the beginning of a comparative period, because then you will have results of depending where the option price has gone in the meantime, what the time value was.
I guess that's why I asked the question about whether it was just a restatement of the opening balance or whether it was a restatement of the comparative. The restatement of the opening balance I agree with absolutely, because that means that you set it up in order to go forward. but the restatement of the prior period, of the comparative period, it just feels to me like you're restating one element. But there's so many other elements that you're not restating that you're ending up with an answer that is reflective neither of the old method nor of the new method.
Are you talking about in relation to just this head, or are you talking more generally?
I'm talking about just the specific, the fact that this one, and I think the next question, so question four and question five, we are restating one portion of a much bigger picture.
Well, I don't think that we think that the way entities hedge with using these options is going to change, and so I don't think there's an arbitrage between the two models if that's...
It wasn't the arbitrage I was worried about. It was more whether the comparators would make sense anymore.
If I can just put it really simplistically, and hopefully I don't say anything offensive here, Martin, I'm sure you'll correct me if I do, but so at the moment, if you had designated an option and you designated it so that you had separated out the intrinsic and the time value would have gone through P&L and your option would have been part of your hedge accounting. All that you would be doing by going back retrospectively would be remeasuring the changes in the time value through OCI and then applying either the time or the transaction-related treatment for the initial time value, put simply. So it's really just changing the way where the entries for the time value go and not really changing anything else, which was why we felt that this would be one suitable place to make an exception from the usual prohibition.
You can also peek into the next question with the net interest margin, for instance, which will be, for the comparators, quite important, whether that is comparable or not.
John?
I have a question. The forward points to OCI, is that a choice, and is it a choice on a hedge-by-hedge basis?
Under the new model, yes, it's a choice, and I believe it's on a hedge-by-hedge basis, but for transition, it would be an all-or-nothing basis because clearly there's a different risk there. Entities are able to go back and choose which ones they do retrospective and which ones they don't.
So tell me all or nothing, how does that work? Any option I had outstanding, I would have to be either
but
in
for the options, only for the forward elements, the next question
any,
already. For the options, mandatory anyway, so there's no choice involved.
Any hedging relationship where the hedging instrument is designated only as the spot element of a forward contract, the entity, for any of relationships like that, the entity would either have to go back and do them all or do none of them.
So when you say required, well, never mind. I understand. Thank you.
Can we vote on question four? Do we agree with the recommendation paragraph 46?
Yes.
Agree.
Okay, so the last question for this segment of the presentation is on what John was referring to just a moment ago. On page 17 of the paper, the staff's recommendation for the retrospective application to forward points. Now, the difference between this and the time value of options is under the new model, time value of options is a mandatory treatment, whereas this alternative treatment for forward points is optional. And so the staff, for that reason, the staff recommends that the retrospective application for forward points also be optional because the treatment is optional, but on an all-or-nothing basis for all affected relationships, so the entity can't cherry-pick, if you will, which ones to go back. So does anyone have any comments or questions about that?
Can we support this? Yes. Okay. That's voted.
Okay. So moving into the next couple of sections of the paper, we're on to kind of the practical accommodations for transition topics. The first one of these is one related to discontinuation and restart. We received the request for entities to be allowed under the new model a one-time on transition or at transition to be able to discontinue relationships optionally and then restart them. in order to address this concern, but in a different way, the staff proposes that entities should be allowed to do this optionally under IAS 39 like they are today, rather than integrating this into the transition of the new model. But then because there can be overnight value changes, and just to smooth the transition from a practical perspective, rather than making entities do this under IAS 39, say, for example, December 31st, and then, you know, overnight January 1st start applying the new model, to allow them to do those two things at the same logical second, discontinue IAS 39 and then immediately apply the new model. And just to be very clear on this point, the purpose is not to allow them to early apply the new model if they're not otherwise early applying it, i.e. also applying everything else in IFRS 9. It's just to be practical and to ease the transition for entities.
I hear silent approval.
Okay, so the second practical accommodation and the last topic in the paper relates to rebalancing, for purposes of which the staff proposes that entities should be allowed to consider the starting point for applying the new model to be the endpoint of applying the old model. And basically why this is an issue is the new model assumes that the hedge ratio has been one that was used in risk management for risk management purposes in the past, but you know, going forward for whatever reason is changing. Whereas for some relationships, now not all, but some relationships under IAS 39, this isn't necessarily the case because that's not the way it's written. And so upon transition, we recommend that entities should be able to consider their IAS 39 hedge relationship as a starting point and then rebalance when they apply the new model. So from a, just from a, I guess to take a step back and say, what does that mean for the financial statements? All along in the hedging relationship, they've been recognizing ineffectiveness, which is now sitting in retained earnings. And then at the date of initial application of these requirements, they would rebalance the hedging relationship. And at that point, any gain or loss on the rebalancing would be recognized in P&L at the date of initial application.
Can we agree? Yes, Stephen?
Why would it go in P&L? Don't understand.
It would go in as ineffectiveness. Martin, correct me if you disagree.
It's just we allow people to apply what they would do on an ongoing basis when they rebalance, which would also go to profit or loss in this case. So in the same logical second we decided on earlier, it just avoids that for those hedging relationships, shouldn't be that many, but where people used a different ratio or whatever reason they had on a 39 today, because as long as you're in 80 to 125%, you can pick it as it is, and now need to use the one that they actually use. They need to switch that. That is similar to ongoing rebalancing. If we don't provide this, they have to discontinue because they don't qualify under the new requirements, and then they have to phase out the previous requirements rather than completely resetting. So discontinuing the first hedge relationship and restarting the next one is actually better as if you account for it as if it was an ongoing rebalancing. And if you did not allow, if you did not require this to go through profit or loss, then actually people might much more try to use this, if that can simply be booked to retained earnings, as an alternative, because it's just you avoid this gain or loss that you have to ever come up. So we, on the one hand, provide them with an opportunity that they don't have to discontinue their relationship, but then they need to take the profit or loss, the gain or loss that would have come through an ongoing
accounting. You're incentivizing them to discontinue and restart.
I think it's not even incentivizing. It's, for me, logic. If we give you a transition that allows you to account for as an ongoing hedge, then you also need to take the PL that comes from rebalancing as an ongoing gain or loss.
Right.
Just a quick question. My understanding, Catherine, with the exception of question four, where we're mandating retrospective application, everything else here is either prohibiting retrospective or permitting an option. And the reason why I voted against four, but four or five, okay, is that I wouldn't object to making all of this prospective. And I'm just wondering why you feel so strongly about the accounting for time value of options and why we could just take that off the table and make this entire thing prospective. I mean, in theory, somebody could manage that, right, because they could have – they see the standard coming 4 or 5 years down the road. They could just reduce or unwind their option position and then start over.
But then you would use a wrong economic hedge only to get a smooth accounting transition.
It may not be all that uneconomic. You might argue that a Ford could do the job just as well. I don't know. But
that, ideally, accounting shouldn't even drive what they use. I think what we really had in mind is comparability. So you have comparability. What actually, getting back to RSA, usually we force people to retrospectively anyway because it provides a better information. Now, hindsight doesn't allow you to mandate that or even allow it. But in those instances that we hear discussed in the paper, we think that hindsight actually essentially does not come much into play on those instances because it is based on designations you had to do in the past. So when the designation has to be done in the past and that hindsight goes away, then using RSA, the superior information is the one that looks back and it avoids this splitting one option into a fair value change before and after the date of transition, which is really not very useful. It's just
I don't disagree, but because, as Daryl highlighted for us, that we're not adopting all the elements of this model retrospectively, I can't foresee. You know, I just don't have the time. I haven't looked at it. I haven't modeled it. Potentially what discontinuities that creates in the information by just choosing this one area of the standard and restating. So.
But the question here is whether you give people the possibility to rebalance, which is a different issue. So this is not limited to time value of options or forward elements. This question number seven is about you have these new requirements that are qualifying criteria for what your hedge ratio must look like. Do you want to give people the chance to do that as an ongoing hedge, or would you force everybody to completely discontinue and restart, even though it's an ongoing thing?
Other questions? Can we support this final recommendation? Okay.
Then the final paper series, agenda paper 16 series. So you probably remember this was an issue you discussed at the last board meeting before the summer break on hedge accounting. You asked the staff to look at whether what you called an assurance approach might work when you hedge credit risk using a CDS, and you would use an accrual accounting type accounting for the CDS when it's used to provide protection against credit risk. So paper 16A explores what that means. It steps you through the main areas of interest when thinking about an accounting solution, so the qualifying criteria, discontinuation, what happens then, the interaction with impairment, which was mostly on the board's minds because obviously you realize that you hedge the credit risk, and that risk is also subject to impairment accounting. And this interaction creates quite some complexity. And then finally, there's one section about what consequences does a typical active and flexible risk management strategy have. So you can't really think that the normal case is that you have one CDS that is perfectly maturity aligned and both the CDS and the credit exposure are held until both expire on the same day. So that's, in short, insurance approach. It looks appealing in the most simplistic scenario that I just described, the problems start on the way out if that is not an aligned maturity date. You have then paper 16B. That is where we explored what you could do if you try to, accounting-wise, get as close as you can, assuming that you would have qualified for risk components. There you have several alternatives also. As you can see, while you have the benefit of having the CDS account for at fair value through profit or loss in all scenarios, the problem here is that the interaction with impairment is actually there, because now you have two competing accounting concepts that try to capture the same phenomenon, which is the credit risk. One is the CDS, which is your insurance, and one is the loan loss allowance that comes out of your general impairment model. It's almost the same as running self-insurance and external insurance together. And then you have paper 16C, which is a compare and contrast paper. So that's where we compare those two approaches to what you've already discussed earlier on as elective fair value through profit or loss approaches. So you now have basically three broad approaches. Insurance accounting means to switch the CDS from fair value to accrual accounting. You have elective fair value accounting, which means to switch the credit exposure from something other than fair value to fair value. And then in the middle, you have these look-alike but not true risk component approach that gets you to a rather targeted solution, but it's quite complex and has the interaction with impairment. So I think it probably makes sense if you discuss those together rather than go sequentially to each paper, because it's pretty much a compare and contrast exercise. As we point out in paper 16C, the problem is that there is no nice answer. All alternatives have drawbacks. So if you're looking for the kind of solution that has no drawbacks, you're not going to find it. But it probably helps when you compare it to what you have today, which certainly is something, if you had to vote for that again, if you view it from that perspective, it tells you that that isn't a nice solution either. So with that, over to the board.
Doug.
Yes, before we discuss further in detail, I still think we don't propose some special treatment for just for CDS. The reason why is currently, because the economy is downtrend, so the CDS creates huge profit. So we have got to do something with it. But I wonder if we have some special treatment for this CDS accounting, then it may end up cover up the risk of CDS itself. If the economy start recover, and then some banks get into the CDS contract when the economy was very bad, then they will have a loss on CDS. But if we have this kind of accounting, then eventually it will cover up the loss on CDS. And the loss on CDS might not be recovered by the revenue generated by the underlying loan. So therefore, I don't think it is really good idea to make some special treatment now. And the one concept I would like to say is for this hedge project, we have one single robust principle, which is risk component must be specially identifiable and reliably measured. But as we discussed, in case of CDS, the credit risk in the loan does not meet this one. So we gave up hedge accounting for CDS, but now we are creating something akin to hedge accounting. Although the hedge accounting itself is as the same, the principle, but we are creating something akin for just for CDS. But then my concern is, what if there are something akin to CDS? Do we create another special treatment? Say, for example, like weather derivative. Weather derivative is a derivative, and the risk is off balance. So we do not have a hedge accounting in the weather derivative. But if somebody argues something like CDS, do we create special standards? So it never ends. So I would rather propose that we just stick to the current hedge accounting project, and we stick to the principle which we established in the hedge accounting.
Yes, please.
One quick clarification only. If your concern is that you don't see the value change on the CDS, then I think, yeah, that would result in concerns over the insurance approach. I think the other approaches show the CDS at fair value of profit or loss, so in that case, that concern would not apply. The concern is then more on the other side, what you do with the item that you try to hedge, or how the mechanics work in the deemed credit adjustment approach.
Stephen?
Well, none of these seem to solve the problem particularly well. The insurance approach I don't like because you haven't got the derivative at fair value, and I think that would be a bad precedent. The deemed credit risk component, is it true, Martin, that some people are already doing this? And is that in a very limited circumstance? You describe all the difficulties very well in here, which means that this doesn't really seem to be that attractive, but what's going to happen to the existing practice that seems to be out there of some people doing this approach?
Well, we usually don't comment on existing practice, but I think the board has been clear in the deliberations that it simply doesn't meet the criteria for the risk components, and hence, whatever you do wouldn't matter.
Okay, and the elective fair value option, I was sort of kind of against this initially because I thought maybe there was a better way of doing it, and I think you've demonstrated that there probably isn't. The problem with it is that you get the interest rate risk reflected in what is a margin business. Have you had indications that whether that's a problem or not? I presume that if somebody wants to do the elective fair value option, they get the benefit of having the offset for the credit risk, and they simply then need to go and hedge the interest rate risk to resolve that part of it. So I got the impression there was quite a lot of support for this in the comment letters. Is that still the case after all this extra analysis that we've done?
I think in the discussions with the outside world, you learn pretty much the same that we learned at this board table, that there is no really nice solution, and people see that. So it's also that when you think you're in a simple scenario, maybe then that solution is attractive, but once you step out of it and realize you're actually not in that simple scenario, that solution becomes quite messy. So once you have to use something that actually involves a lot of calculations and tracking, people are getting concerned about the operational aspects. I think where people are still clear is that either alternative of elective fair value of profit loss would still be a very welcome step forward compared to where they are today, because of all the approaches, today's status quo seems to be the one where people have the most trouble. While it's operationally obviously very easy, you don't do anything other than your default accounting, it has these huge swings where you have a phase shift between the gains on the CDS and the losses on the instrument. And that is the most important concern. And then there are different preferences how to fix that. People weigh differently depending on what strategy they have, what exposures they have, and how they manage it between operational aspects and so on. But I think all that we discussed here would be more welcome than what you have today.
John?
You asked the question, which one of these would we prefer, I guess, go for, and I would agree with the comments that I've heard about either of them seem to be working very well. But you also have a recommendation in paragraph 46, and you don't ask us whether or not we agree with it.
Because we are still at the discussion stage. I didn't want to push you straight into the recommendation.
Okay. So agree with anything that defers this further down the road, but it also seemed to me that you've identified two solutions. There probably are more that could be thought about.
Yep.
And when I look at what you've recommended in 46, that would add a little more time rather than trying to pursue something that on either side of the two you've got, they're not particularly attractive. So I wouldn't develop either of these. I'd wait until we understand what we're doing on impairment and then see if there's a way to line this up or perhaps another way to approach this.
PK?
Yeah, consistent with, I was not enthusiastic at the exposure draft time frame for fair value through profit and loss account, but looking at other alternatives, I think not putting the life derivative at fair value is not right, so insurance approach is gone for that. So if there is any legs to this thought, it's perhaps the fair value through profit and loss account on the loan commitment side. On the loan side, that's I think has the most appeal to it. One question though, now that if it has to be done through FTPL, if that is the only one, if I listen to staff's para 46, although it's a discussion, not a suggestion, then what is your plan? How do you plan to do it? M&IAS 37, bring it into IFRS 9, how does this all work? Can you explain if we go down the path of FTPL?
I mean, in terms of drafting, you could either let it reside as just the last bit of a hedge accounting chapter, although it doesn't really belong there, but otherwise I just slot in the paragraph and that guidance in the classification measurement section, but that's a drafting thing. Ultimately, you change the accounting
and
hedge accounting is one way of changing it, and the normal measurements are one way of changing, like we have the fair value option where we change the normal measurement on a more permanent basis. I'd say that the fact that this can start and be discontinued lends itself a bit more to outside the normal measurements, which you couldn't. But it's a drafting thing, so wherever people think it should be residing, I don't think that's
But we need to definitely touch 37 to say that we definitely have to touch 37, right? How can we not touch 37 to bring this into the picture? I appreciate it's a drafting issue.
Well, you can do it in the same way as hedge accounting, where also if there's something, a liability in 37 that is being hedged, or it's inventory in IS2, because hedge accounting is this generic change of a measurement if you qualify as a hedged item. You could say credit exposures that qualify under the qualifying criteria that are set on the papers, and then that automatically means that a credit exposure that is in 37 would be eligible. Otherwise, you do it in the scope of 37, but I don't think it's necessary.
Patricia?
Like PK, I support the fair value through profit and loss for the other piece as well, but procedurally, John said, in 46, the staff said, why don't we wait till we know what we're doing with impairment? But then the second part of 46 is, but this is a really timely thing, so we should address it. But we just voted to make the hedging piece no earlier than January 1st, 15, unless you wanted to do early application, and then you had to adopt everything early. So even if the board agrees on one method to fix this, how is it going to really soon address the problem in the market?
Well, first of all, whatever you want to fix, you can't fix if you don't make it available. That's one thing. The other thing is, in the papers, I already indicated where there is a lot of interaction with impairment on the best knowledge that I have about the impairment project and where you have been and what you're discussing, broadly what the interaction might be. So I think it is a very fundamental decision whether you want something that is actually dependent on impairment and has this conflict that you then need to manage between the impairment model and the accounting for the credit hedge, because you accept that there will be competing models on an ongoing basis, or whether you go for an approach which would be either insurance or elective fair value through profit or loss that cuts it, and then you only have one model that looks after the credit risk. So, for instance, if you change it to alternative two of fair value through profit or loss, then there is no interaction anymore. So then you have no competing models. There is only one model that picks up the credit risk, and then you don't need to manage the interaction with anything else.
I think at a more simple level too, though, that one of the messages in paragraph 46 is, I think, Martin, that even if the board decided today that we don't have the solution on the table today, and that might be wiser to wait and look at the wait until we have the full impairment picture to finalise this anyway, the messaging to the market, I think, is important, that it doesn't mean that it's going to get swept under the carpet and that the board's going to forget about it, that we do realise that it's an important issue and it will be addressed. It's just a matter of phasing it with the other projects. Do you think that's a fair point, Martin?
Yeah, so that's basically what we say. You have two strategic alternatives. You can do something as part of this project. This is the last opportunity. Or you can defer it and see where impairment comes out. But given how often we have discussed it already, personally, I'm not too optimistic that trying to manage the overlap with impairment is going to be a very promising approach, and you could go another full circle and be no step further.
But back to PK's point, you're not suggesting, if we could agree on a methodology, to do a separate amendment to IAS 39 that would be effective sooner than
Not as in accordance with this proposal, no.
Daryl, did you want to say something?
I mean, if you wanted to think about it. But
I suppose I would agree with the analysis that Steve did in terms of looking at the three different models and coming to the conclusion that the fair value one is the least unattractive of the three models. I still have the concerns, and I think you've just said it, that we've discussed that model a number of times and we haven't necessarily come to a solution each time we've discussed it. And I think it's around the concern that it still feels to me, certainly if I look at it, and particularly if I look at alternative two, that profit that gets released on day one of my decision to actually change to fair value, that profit or loss that gets released, feels to me like it's manipulatable. And in the document here, you talk about the fact that in most circumstances where companies would choose to use this, it's when the credit is declining, so in fact they would recognize a loss. And I would agree with that, but I'd say that would be in most circumstances where companies choose to legitimately use this. That's going to be the circumstances. Tuck's point about the fact that we're in a cycle now where potentially we're reversing out, and what's going to happen is I'm going to be realizing losses on my credit default swap, and I have a retrospective opportunity with this to say, well, let me choose now to suddenly fair value the asset and take the profit on the fair value in the asset through the income statement. I guess that's the real thing that concerns me about where we are now. But I think we can sort that out. I think that's easy enough to resolve. But it still sort of comes back to the overall point that it feels like we've gone through a good exercise. I think we've gone through a very hard exercise to find something else that works, and we keep coming back to a model that we seem to have tested through this forum a couple of times. So I don't think that holding out, delaying this decision, is going to provide any hope. If we haven't come to a conclusion now, I can't see us coming to a conclusion in the future. We either have to take this least bad option, but then, in Tuck's words, the problem then is that what we're doing is we are creating an exception for one specific circumstance, or we have to accept that we just can't resolve this problem within the current framework of where we stand.
Just quick, because I also thought about this, how large or attractive could be a gain when you get into this. But when you think about, you come from something that's either unrecognized or it is amortized cost. So unless you go to a lower value with an impairment loss, you could also use reversal, supposedly, if it picks up. So that's not a gain that you would only get if you bought a CDS, because you reverse the impairment loss, have the gain as well. So the real gain that you could get without reversing an impairment loss is if it goes beyond almost par or something, where there is some upside, but that's much more limited compared to what's the downside, obviously. So you will not have a loan getting to 200% of the face value.
It is limited, but it provides that opportunity.
It is there, but it's not the kind of big-ticket item usually.
I suspect that Tuck may be making a very positive assumption here that the market's going to turn up. But if the market does turn up, and given where loans have been advanced at the moment, on the assumption of fair, so there is definitely room for loans to reprice above nominal, I would have thought. And it just feels like it provides an opportunity there, and it feels like it might be something we could protect ourselves from.
Doc?
Just quickly, my observation is that the volatility of the CDS is much larger than that of the loan. And then what I'm afraid is that sometimes financial institution or some normal people may get very high-priced CDS when the economy is going down and fear the crisis. So then pick up the high-priced CDS. That risk could be larger than the risk which contains in the loan. I'm not sure. I'm not 100% sure, but I'm afraid such kind of situation. So if we had a special accounting treatment, it may cover up such situations. That is the point I'm quite afraid of. If I'm wrong, please correct me.
But I don't understand how that happens under an approach where the CDS is account for fair value of profit or loss. What more can you do? I mean, other than prohibiting people buying CDSs, there's not much you can do. So I think under those approaches, I would not be too concerned about that.
We are not touching the CDS accounting. That's always a derivative. That's always a throughput. All we are trying to do is match it by bringing the loan commitment to the fair value.
Sure.
So that there's no timing issue coming here.
But isn't what Tak's saying is that they won't match necessarily because the risks are different?
Oh, yeah, because of the risk component issue.
Yeah. And then you see the mismatch. I mean, most CDSs are not maturity aligned, and most are systematically longer maturity of the CDS than the exposure. So that's what you then see coming through PL as it happens.
John? Would the ability to use fair value reduce some of the concerns? Granted, it's not going to be perfect, but would that at least, recognizing because there's differences in the instrument, there'll be some noise, but is that better than the way it is now?
Yeah. I mean, people acknowledge that there's noise, so the credit portfolio managers know that by having to structurally, because of basically can only buy sensibly on-the-run CDSs, so they're around the five-year mark, and then they become illiquid.
Why isn't fair value option available for a loan commitment?
So for the loan commitment, it's not a financial instrument if it's scoped out. So for the loan commitments that are in the scope, they're already, most of them.
That is
a profit or loss, but the fair value option only applies to financial items that are in the scope of what is the financial instrument standard.
And for loans?
Well, for loans, it's inside, so that's obviously...
They can already do that now, right?
On initial recognition.
But only on initial recognition. So when you decide to take out the CDS 6 months after you entered into the loan, for instance, it doesn't have to be in a crisis. It can be that you have concentration risk because now that client wants the facility, and then you say, well, okay, I need to take that loan directly. Well, then I can use the CDS, for instance, to manage the concentration risk under the normal limit, and that's not something you could necessarily foresee.
But the problem, if you don't do it at inception and forever,
then the option is gone.
Open it up for everything else. Why are we requiring it at inception forever?
Because that's where you don't have the narrow qualifying criteria here, where you need name matching, seniority matching, and depending on its approach, that the maturity needs to be at least as long for the CDS. So it's not as freely available at all like the general fair value option, where a pretty broad mismatch on a portfolio level might even be something that gets you there. So this, as we say in the paper, actually, for a portfolio CDS, which is a pretty broad affair, this one wouldn't work because of the qualifying criteria.
So, Martin, would you like to lead us to the questions?
Yeah. So the first question is, which approach would you like? So that's basically insurance approach, deemed credit adjustment, or elective variance of profit or loss. The next question I will ask is then, which of the sub-variations do you want to pick once we know which approach is there that gives board members who were in the minority approach still a say on the sub-variation of the approach where the majority is? Yeah, I mean, this is actively voting for, obviously. Otherwise, we could here be here until midnight if we try to screen it out the other way around.
I think I heard a lot of people speaking in favor of the fair value for profit and loss, so let's see if that can generate a majority here. Now, which subvariant?
The variation 2, do you want to vote on that?
2?
I think that's where people are heading.
Maybe explain what 2 is.
2 is when you immediately take the profit or loss, the gain or loss to profit or loss. There's no measurement change adjustment that requires a little impairment test for a little bit that is carried forward at amortized cost, as there is under alternative 3. So that is the cleanest slate in terms of delinking impairment and move to full fair value accounting for what you mentioned.
Okay.
Okay.
This is obviously the concern, and what Darrell was saying about the earnings management risk potentially from just deciding when you put on the CDS. What happens if I buy a CDS, apply fair value, and 1 week later get rid of the CDS?
The 1 week fair value change that you would have ends then up like any other switch from fair value to amortized cost that you have, that you start treating the fair value on the day that you discontinue as the new deemed cost, so as if you had acquired it on that day.
So I could put on this hedge, in inverted commas, for 1 day in order to get in the income statement the difference between book value and fair value of the loan.
And it costs you a lot of money crossing the bid-ask spread on CDSs.
Sure. You could, of course, achieve the same thing simply through selling the loan and buying it back again. But then we start to get into IFRS 9 issues. But is this subject to the transaction cost? Is this a simple way of just realizing the profit inherent in a...
It is a very expensive way of doing that. And as we set out, I think it's quite important that you look at the disclosure that we also have proposed here, because that tells you actually a reconciliation what has happened in terms of in-out, and it also tells you on discontinuation, when you look at paragraph 45C, the differences that you have. So if people have many small differences, essentially.
What about a separate line item on the face of the P&L for the measurement change adjustment? Well, we're requiring it for selling out of amortized cost, aren't we? And this, to me, is a very similar situation. Maybe it's not going to be material in the vast majority of cases, and in which case it won't be disclosed. But
well, I think, first of all, the main reason why you have these often mismatched maturities is because it is really expensive with a bit of spread in the CDS market. So, and then with the disclosure that you have, you can actually see what they're doing, and you know that they're wasting shareholders' money and don't know what they're doing if they have this flip-flopping all the time. That's, I think, the only thing that you can understand. You can see in the notes, you can discuss whether you want to elevate it to the face of the income statement, but you can see in the notes the profit or loss, more likely, that came out of that in a given year. And given that otherwise in the impairment project you are trying to get people to recognize losses early anyway, well...
Okay, I'm just pushing. I support option 2. Yeah.
Okay. Check the vote.
Just playing hard to get, huh?
No, not
now
really.
For option two, who can support option two? Yes.
So just then to be clear, I take that you, having read the paper and the staff recommendation, that that includes the disclosures under paragraph 45. And then there was also one aspect in terms of discontinuing that for loan commitment. And that gave you basically two ways of doing it. Either you apply the IAS 37 type accounting where you freeze the amount when you discontinue this, and then if the loan gets drawn later on from the commitment, you would capitalize it into the loan. Otherwise, that amount stays frozen, and when the loan commitment expires, you recognize that as a gain. The staff said there's probably a better case to say you amortize that like you would do for a loan, first of all, because you have usually commitment fees that are ticking along. Second, the credit risk can only arise if the loan commitment gets drawn. If there's no drawing, you can't lose anything. And thirdly, especially this is often for corporate revolving facilities, you will, with every change in the drawing, then play a game where you need to capitalize it, start amortizing, and so on, and adjust the amortization. So for that reason, the staff have said you should look at amortizing that also for loan commitments. Is that also what the board wants to do? Okay.
Thank you.
So does this mean you're finished, Sir Martin?
With, yeah.
Yeah.
Is this the end of basic accounting?
Yeah, I think I would like to say a couple of things about it. I think we have indeed come to the end of the general hedging decisions, and I would like to congratulate the staff on this accomplishment and the very hard work that has been done. Special word of appreciation to Henry Venter. I understand this is the last time he is among us, and although you will continue working very close to us geographically, you will no longer be working in this building. We wish you a lot of success, and thank you very much for all the efforts that you have done, especially on this project. We did not see a due process paper on whether we have followed the due process sufficiently. I think that considering the fact that we remain very close to the exposure draft, we could normally propose to go into balloting at this moment. However, I think it would be wise for us to take an intermediate step, which would be to finalize a staff draft and put it on our website. That could serve a couple of purposes. It could give the outside world another opportunity to consider the clarified wording of these rather far-reaching decisions that we have taken, and it would have the additional benefit of giving our colleagues at FASB to give them time to take another integral look at our proposals and decide which way they would like to go forward on hedge accounting themselves. I would like to reiterate that this does not mean that we are not going to finalize our redeclarations. It does not mean we're going to re-expose staff draft and, well, for the purposes that I have mentioned. I would like to know if people have similar views of or different views. Open the floor. John.
Does an alternative view go with the staff draft, or does it go up there by itself?
We probably do it with a full basis, so I guess an alternative view would, could go.
There you go.
I said we would probably do a staff draft with a full basis, so we could put an alternative view in as part of that.
I wonder who that would come from.
What are you saying? Just one person, huh?
It's an innocent question. Yes, please, Vago.
Prepare any outreach or not? You know, there are two kinds. One yes. kind is we're not sure, just like leasing and insurance, or that particular leasing, and they were targeted questions. Another one is mainly for marketing purpose. We're sure at all, and
yeah, more for educational purposes.
Yes.
For another round, we are not sure, and please give us your opinion, right? It would be to clarify our
view of the words, not to ask people if they agree with it. We're not talking re-exposure.
Oh, yeah.
PK?
So can staff help us to understand when would the staff draft would be ready under the circumstances? Another 15 days, 1 month, 2 months, then is it 120 days you want to put it up on the website? What is the thought process on that?
It's hard to tell. So the decisions made at this meeting we have to integrate. So we already have a staff draft that covers large areas that were decided until he took the break going into August, and once that is done, so it might be, I think, a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And we hopefully have a staff draft.
And I guess one question would be how much review the board would like to have in the document before it gets posted on the website. What we've done previously with staff drafts has been a sort of negative assurance type approach where it's been made available and board members can, you know, confirm if they're happy with it, but we didn't actually ask for sort of formal comments on it. We could go that approach, or we could ask for more.
Did you say the basis of conclusions would accompany it?
Yes.
So don't board members have to
write the basis of conclusions? It would be. Seems to me they go hand in hand.
It would be there, huh?
It would be there. In the past, we haven't balloted staff drafts, and I think they've had basis on with it. Consoles?
But what would be the timing of the staff draft to be hanging on the balance on the website?
Well, I think that's one question. I think that to give comfort to many of our or most of our constituents who are very keen to see this finalised sooner rather than later, I think we should, if we put a staff draft on the website, it should have a definite time frame associated with it, and I don't think it should be too long. We don't want this to turn into something that just never gets finalised. So not sure if Hans has thoughts on that, but I would have thought sort of 3 months or something like
90 days
would be a reasonable time frame, so it's not too long.
Elke?
Same question as PK, and I would consider 4 weeks from now and 90 days makes it before people have to close their accounts, and makes perfect sense to me.
Just a suggestion. We are trying for the last 5 minutes to anticipate what is not really possible to anticipate. So considering the staff comments that in a couple of weeks, I suggest that an update is provided in our joint meeting in Norwalk, and then it's disclosed to the outside world in where we are. If the it's ready on the website or it's not, it's in a couple of weeks. So I think we'll have a better disclosure process.
Jan?
Well, I see benefits in your proposal of doing this. I've been a board member for 7 years, and I've participated in some discussions that have not brought the world to much of a better place. I think this is one of the best or the best project we have had, and I think we're really changing things from not so good into better. Sorry, John. And as we've had the outreach, and I said it before, I participated in 70 or 80 meetings or whatever, and all over people were asking for this. So I think it's very, very important that we decide that we are backing this, like you say, that we don't give the impression that we are up for sort of a review.
And the benefit with this is, of course, that we give the Americans a chance of understanding how smart we are. And I think they will understand that helped by, if I understand correctly, quite a few of the large American companies who are very positive, auditing companies very positive. And we have to get a few users also to show us that they are as smart as the users the rest of the world. And if we can do that, I think it's worthwhile. But we must not give the impression that we are sort of up for to rediscuss everything, because I think we have a solid solution now that really improves financial reporting. I would hate to go backwards.
So noted. Philippe?
I agree with Jan, and also because we are not going to make this effective before 2015, there is no reason to rush publishing a final document. I think we need to have some time to convince ourselves of how smart we are. For that purpose, we need to be able to speak with the outside world and to get more support and more input from our constituents. And I just would plea for this staff draft to be as final as possible in terms of drafting. I would hate to put out a document that has not been sufficiently cleared by the board and then to make changes which might be substantial in terms of drafting. Otherwise, we have to redeliberate everything, and I don't think we are going to redeliberate unless our friends from the U.S. Want to participate and bring in some new ideas, which could be a reason for us eventually reopening some decisions, but otherwise I think we have deliberated. But if we put out a document which is not in final drafting form and then make changes, we will have to explain to the world and in public why we make changes. So that's a new round of discussions which I think we should avoid.
Well, I'm sure the staff are capable of coming very close to a final draft. And I've already noticed that the colleagues from FASB look very impressed by our smartness. So that should be an easy task. Stephen.
I agree with the comments that Jan's made. I think this is an important improvement in financial reporting, and I think it'll be a great an improvement of the usefulness of financial statements to users. I've got a question, though. Two questions. One is the interaction with the macro hedging model and the timing of this and the timing of when we might finalize as regards the macro model. And is there an interaction there between how long we take before we finalize this? And the other one is just the sort of the procedure and due process around this. Presumably there are no questions in this thing. It is a staff draft of the final standard. In that case, there can be no comment period. I don't see how we can say we want comments back within 90 days when we're not asking for comments. Why don't we, presumably we are going to set a date at which we are going to come back and discuss, are we going to finalize? Why don't we say that we are not going to discuss finalization of the document before the board meeting in whichever month it is. And that indicates to people that if they wish to send us comments on drafting or get in touch with us or have an education session, then that is the timeline that we're thinking about in terms of finalization of the document.
That makes sense. On previous staff drafts, what we've done is we haven't formally solicited comments. Sometimes people do send us comments, so there's no formal comment process as such, so I agree with that. I think that's a sensible suggestion as well. On your question on macro and general hedge accounting, at least at a staff level, we see those as two quite distinct models. We're not trying to tweak the general hedge accounting model to get a macro hedge accounting model. We see it as potentially a fundamentally different thing. And so I would not want to see the timing of the general hedge accounting model getting caught up in the timing of the macro, personally.
Pat?
My question or observation goes to, I guess, what Stephen was just raising, and I think maybe what others have raised. We have a decision we've taken recently to defer the effective date of IFRS 9 to 1/1/15. It's already been brought to our attention that some people do not want to adopt current elements of IFRS 9 until they see all the other phases of accounting for financial instruments completed. So I guess the question is in light of that, and in light of the push towards convergence, how could we ever envision putting a final stamp on this chapter in IFRS 9 until all the pieces are completed? I just don't understand that. It seems contrary to all the discussion we've been having recently with respect to trying to help people understand how the pieces fit together and with the view towards convergence. It just doesn't make any sense. So I appreciate the enthusiasm that, you know, Jan is articulating and others have articulated. It just doesn't make any sense to me, though, that you would even contemplate finishing this, putting a final stamp on it until you know what your CNM model is, what your impairment model is, and it's brought together and you know more or less how it differs from where the FASB is. That's a pretty scary thought. I recognize that. But to say that we're going to put a stamp on this in the next year, I think is pretty presumptuous on our part. And also, I think it presumes that we know what the EC is going to say.
Since when does that decide what we do?
But also, prior to this discussion, it's always been the project plan and what I thought the intention of the board was to proceed to basically finalise this now. Yeah. So even this idea of a staff draft is a big change.
I agree.
We have said that IFRS 9 is going to be finalized in phases, and this is one phase of that. We've done the same with financial asset classification and measurement, and then we did liabilities. We've also said at some point after it's all done, we take a look at the big picture. But I don't think that should cause us to postpone finalizing the general hedging standard.
Okay.
And discussion, the point that Steve made, I just want to understand so that we can tell the constituents about this. When you put the staff draft, would we not normally explain what has changed since the last exposure draft? As some place to explain changes made since exposure draft? I thought that's what the comments are going to be on that. That's what I was thinking, because when people say, what's the staff draft, what has changed since then, I need to explain it. So we normally have that, right? So
we already have a comprehensive slide deck where we explain all the changes and the confirmations that have been done over the entire redeliberation. So I think that can be provided and people can very easily see, okay, these are the
excellent
items.
Excellent.
Okay.
I'm still a bit scared by Pat's comments, and I think so far we have always said in IFRS 9 that we're going in phases, and this is one where we didn't have much controversy. We have rather a group, the non-financials, urging us to get this across the finishing line, and I would full-heartedly agree what Stephen said, except that I would not say we are not looking at this again before, but I would rather say we're looking at this again in be it January, be it February, so that it's not something which looks like, and we'll do that sometime.
John?
When we did classification measurement, after doing it, we got a lot of pushback on many different things we should change. And we also got comments from constituents saying, I adopted this, and now you're going to make me change. I think in terms of getting this done, if we are going to issue it in 90 days plus 4 weeks, we ought to be very clear as to whether or not we're going to be converged or not with the FASB. And it's okay if we say we're not, but if we put that out there and say, go ahead and early adopt, we're going to create another problem for ourselves if we're trying to converge after that. So we need to get that behind us one way or the other.
That's a decision we need to take 4 months from now, not today.
I think that's all I was trying to say.
It's related to a general term of the, we will, you know, express on this document. On nine, particularly classification and measurements,
we emphasize and repeat again and again. After FSB finalize their part, we will expose their house and consider whether we will take into consideration their documents and the views from constituencies. I'm not sure whether we should have exactly the same explanation on hedging. I don't think so.
Well, to date, the scope of the FASB's project has been completely different to ours, so I don't think I don't think that would make sense in this case to say we're going to wait and expose their hedge accounting. And they've already got wraparound comments on our proposals.
Let us not get ahead of ourselves. We are just continuing as planned with an intermediate step of a staff draft. That's all. And in anything else, we are proceeding as we have always done to proceed. Major advantage being first of all, we have a little bit more time to convince parts of the market that are still skeptical, and I think it could be very, if we really think this is very worthwhile, what we are doing for users, to create more transparency about current business practices. It would be a pity if this skepticism, if we could not eliminate it by providing more information and education about this project. That's one. The second thing is this also gives FASB, who, like ourselves, have been working very hard on a number of projects, gives them a little bit more time to get a complete look at our proposals and to see whether this is something they like or not. That will be very important for us to know. And then we'll see. But for now, we are going on with our method of working with a small intermediate step. Yes? I think we're in agreement here. Thank you very much. Okay. This is the end of the meeting.
Thank you.